the average American, if they sit down on a Monday morning and answer emails during the week, and that's all they do, they just answer their emails that they're getting, a week's worth of emails they wouldn't stop answering until mid-Thursday afternoon. So that's Monday morning through till mid-Thursday afternoon, just answering emails. If you then throw in all the meetings they're invited to, it's something like, from memory, about 137% of a working week just going to meetings and answering emails, if you did it all. So you've got all of this stuff dragging you backwards and stopping you from actually going and doing productive work.
I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Dr. Richard Claydon to the Smart Business Transformation podcast, the show that helps people with a growth mindset who are leading transformation programs. Now, Richard, I'm going to have a little go at introducing you, but I'll probably just hand over to you in a minute to tell me how well I did. But you're basically a transdisciplinary behavioral strategist, an organizational misbehaviorist, and an ironist. You have a fascinating background. I mean, my sort of assumption is you're kind of Dilbert meets McKinsey, but I'm sure you'll tell me in a minute whether I'm sort of right or not. But, I mean, you're currently Director of People, Culture and Change for CSC Asia Pacific. You have a degree in Fine Arts and Visual Studies, an MA in Cross-Cultural Communication and International Management, and a PhD in Management. And, I mean, there's management gurus in America calling you a touchstone for future work in management and currently at the forefront of modern debate. Can you try and unpack for us exactly what you do and what you are, please?
So I think the Dilbert McKinsey definition, I think I prefer the Dilbert side of it than the McKinsey potentially. I would quite often do very opposing things to what McKinsey tries to do in organizations. I would sort of sit in quite oppositional to some of their major theories. So what exactly do I do? Well, the transdisciplinary behavioral strategist thing, that's sort of an advisory kind of role for organizations that are looking to develop leaders in different ways, trying to move leadership into the future so that they're much more aware of future work skills, collaboration practices, creativity, critical thinking, all of these kind of things. How do you hire people who might fit this? Because the standard way of looking for leaders is not necessarily the way that you're going to find these kind of skill sets. So that's really what I do there. And really, again, look at how people behave and during relentless change as well. So, you know, when you're seeing certain behavioral patterns, is it because the person is resisting change, or is it because they're actually just shattered, or exhausted, totally confused by what's going on, rather than deliberately saying, I don't want to change. So there's a whole bunch of stuff around change and leadership that I do on that part of my work. The organizational misbehaviorists thing, really we're looking at some reported statistics on misbehaviors in organization. We look at the distrust has gone through the roof. People have stopped trusting politicians specifically, but also there's been real problems since 2008 with trusting leaders and CEOs, etc. So you've got a real loss of trust in the part of the social and the leadership in the organizational domains. You've then got DRAG, which is outdated methodologies of management that are costing organizations in profitability and performance. You have distraction, which is the mobile phones that's causing quite a lot of psychological conditions in workplaces. People are unable to concentrate, unable to focus on work for very long. So the current research suggests people get distracted from a task every 3 minutes and 5 seconds and respond to that by working very quickly, which results in irritation, or taking work home with them, which results in disengagement. Disease, we're looking at, again, the fact that the workplaces today are actually genuinely hurting people and causing physiological problems. And finally, disengagement, that The standard Gallup stat is 87% of people are disengaged. We actually don't think that you can solve disengagement by looking at disengagement. You are looking at the other elements of misbehavior. And we really focus on the word miss of misbehavior. We're not saying things that people are behaving badly. They're misbehaving. So there's the idea that good behaviors are being misperceived as bad behaviors and vice versa. So you're just trying to arrange and organize how people are behaving and explain why that's going on. The ironist piece is really down to my own PhD research. And we just look at, looks at two specific elements of organizations. It's the idea that there's always a gap between the organizational rhetoric and organizational reality. And there's always a gap between aspirations and achievements. And once you start seeing this gap, how do you then behave and survive and thrive in it? So that's what the research sort of picks out. And really the people that the research looks at are what, if I move out of the ironist space, they're sort of the high performers in transformational conditions. That's really what we've found, and we try to identify through all aspects of my work.
Richard, there's so much to talk about there, but before we get into some of the meat, I'm really curious, what was the moment in your life when you aspired to become an organizational misbehaviorist?
The ironic manager stuff, I was doing that with Dr. Richard Badham, who's professor of organizational behavior at MGSM in Sydney. I think it's now been rebranded as Macquarie Business School. And we were doing that for a long time, but unfortunately, you can't sell irony to organizations. It was fun and it was interesting, and we got interviewed on national radio and bits and pieces were going on. But there was never any way you could have a career as underpinned by the concept of irony in organizations. So I met with a consultant friend in Sydney. He was leaving Sydney, as I was, and we said, look, we're both leaving, and why don't we see if we put a business together? And we were looking at the sort of solving. Really, if I go right back to the beginning of the story, he was doing a workshop on organizational toxicity, and he asked me if I had any stuff to help, any research, any research papers, any bits and pieces. And I gave him all my stuff, and I helped him put the workshop together. And then I went off to Hong Kong, and he gave it in Sydney. And the response was incredible. It was a Women in Tech event, and the response was incredible. The whole room blew up, and all these women were talking about how they were bullied and abused, and there were tears, and they cancelled the next speaker because there was so much energy in the room. And after that, he called me back. He says, look, we've got to do something about this. How should we do it? How do we turn what I've just done into a bunch of interventions? And we'd played around with ideas, and because I wasn't happy with just saying, well, it's toxicity and toxic people. I was saying, no, the toxicity isn't really the person. It's quite often the organization that rewards certain behaviors, and it causes toxicity in the people. So it's environmental rather than individual qualities. So he suggested organizational misbehavior. So it was really something he did that I helped. And then he came back and it was his idea to say, okay, you're not happy with toxicity. You're not happy with there's these bad people in organizations. So maybe misbehavior is the right term. And it seemed to fit with the fact that we were looking at misperceived behaviors all the time.
I see. Now, you've described this as being a $3 trillion problem. Can you just unpack that a bit more for us, please?
So really, we were just looking at I was trying to do a breakdown of how much money bad behaviors cost according to our 5 Ds of distrust, drag, distraction, disease, and disengagement. And it's not easy to do, but when you start looking through the figures, so Gary Hamel of London Business School, he argues that drag in itself is costing the US economy $3 trillion annually.
You say drag?
Yeah, so bureaucracy. The example I presented on email usage and meeting attendance. So if the average American, if they sit down on a Monday morning and answer emails during the week. And that's all they do. They just answer their emails that they're getting. A week's worth of emails they wouldn't stop answering until mid-Thursday afternoon. So that's Monday morning through till mid-Thursday afternoon, just answering emails. If you then throw in all the meetings they're invited to, it's something like, from memory, about 137% of a working week just going to meetings and answering emails, if you did it all. So you've got all of this stuff dragging you backwards and stopping you from actually going and doing productive work. The amount of distraction we have as well, so that most people, given the number of times they're distracted during a working week or a day, only really end up doing about 2.5 hours of productive work. Everything else is being, dragged across different parts of the organization, helping other people, answering emails. You're not actually doing much of what you're being paid to do in the value-adding activity. So that, we looked at all the figures. I think 3 trillion is actually quite conservative, because if you start looking at the drag figure and the disease figure, you're beginning to add many, many more billions onto the figure. And so really, you're just sort of saying, look, we've got to the point where we've designed organizations that are supposedly making us more and more productive. We've got all of these technologies to make us more productive. We've got all these theories that sort of about how we should work. And they're not. We're suffering some of the worst productivity stats in the history of the Western world. We're not improving our productivity rates anywhere near the level we used to. People are getting more and more stressed. People are desperately unhappy at work. Not everyone, but a lot of people are. So you add all of this together. You take all the numbers from different reports, and it adds up to a huge amount of money.
Well, I mean, this is so big. It almost seems to be rivaling sort of climate change in terms of its impact on the universe.
I presented in Sydney. So we did a masterclass in Sydney I can't remember where it was, about a year ago now. And someone afterwards sort of came up, when we sort of took them through the whole experience, and they said, well, you're talking about people have been in the war zone. It's post-traumatic stress syndrome. That's what some people are experiencing. That's really what you're describing. I think that part of that can happen. I mean, we've seen people break down in tears. I don't want to mention any names, but I have personal friends that I sort of consult to on a pro bono basis over in Hong Kong, and I've had them in tears from stuff that's just happening at work, which is really, there's no reason for, they haven't done anything wrong. They're just feeling totally and utterly under pressure to do things in ways that perhaps aren't the way that they felt that should be done, or there's no way for them to solve the problem, and yet the problem's being thrown on their head and they have no power to do anything about it. So their purpose and their meaning and their raison d'etre sort of flows out of them, and they end up breaking down. And for me, there's 40 years worth of research showing this happening in sort of strong culture, high tech kind of organizations. And now everybody's becoming strong culture and high tech with the digital transformation revolution going on. This kind of stuff is happening more and more. It's pretty intense. And I think it's a major problem for the Western world at the moment.
Now, I'm conscious that we're talking problems here, not solutions, but I do want, really want to understand this a little bit more before we move into the brave new future. Is this, I'm understanding this is an international trend, but are there any particular pockets of particularly good and particularly bad that you see in your research?
So there are types of company rather than particular pockets. I mean, you've obviously got some of the companies in some of the European countries who are reducing working hours so that you're not getting that I'm stuck at work for 50, 60 hour week kind of stuff going on that you get in the States. There are companies that you look at and you go, that's the model that you should be following. And for me, there's this idea. It's not particularly new. It's a decentralization of the work. It's ownership of contextual problems rather than having everything centralized and you're just reporting to the numbers. There's a much more contextual obliquity going on. They're trusting you to understand the contextual problems, and they're trusting the frontline staff to solve them. And then what gets solved can get reported back through the system, and then you have a whole bunch of experimental possibilities that you might use for similar problems that pop up elsewhere in your organization. So there's a certain type of organization that's beginning to emerge that is solving this problem. But I don't think there's a specific country necessarily. I would love to have said Scandinavia. I mean, I lived and worked in Scandinavia for years. But the feedback I have from my Scandinavian friends is that it's impacting Scandinavia as well. It's not what it was when I was working there.
Now, on your blog, you talk about Bob Sutton's statement that 2017 was the year of peak arsehole. was that just because it was 2017 at the time, and that was as bad as it's got, or are we now on a bit of decline from a historic peak?
So Sutton's work is something that it's interesting. And we use, coming out of Australia, we use the term dicks and dickheads rather than assholes, and when we're going into the emotive language, there's this idea that you have assholes and dickheads, and they're people that you hire, and as long as you get rid of them, everything's going to be fine. I don't think that's the case. I think that organizational structure at the moment, and culture and reporting systems and targets and short-termism and all of this kind of incentivization creates people who are perfectly nice people, but it creates bad behaviors in them. It makes them assholes and dickheads. So Sutton's work is interesting because he calls it out, but I don't think he's necessarily got to the I don't think we're going to get to the point where there's a peak asshole year. I think it's something that's quite systemic at the moment, and we need to look deeply into what's causing it rather than, it's just don't hire assholes, which is one of his main solutions.
Now, earlier on, you said you much prefer the Dilbert side rather than McKinsey. And I'm sort of getting a flavour of that, but sort of moving into more sort of solution orientated space. Whereabouts in an organisation are the solutions going to come from? I mean, the temptation, I think, with all these things is to say it has to start at the top. But is there, is the things that people up and down, even, in the mailroom could be doing to try and resolve some of these issues?
So for me, there are three ways that you could view this. And one is a sort of a top-down solution, one is a bottom-up solution, and the other one is an open-source solution. And that's the one I believe in. You can run experiments to fix this anywhere in the organization. It really comes down to the people in the organization. They know their jobs. And if you give them the opportunity to make that job easier and more purposeful, and you say, look, how can we help you to make this job less painful for you? What do you need to make this job less painful? And they'll know, and they'll be able to. And if you're giving them the opportunity to start trying to solve this, they will. The challenge there is they're very often so conditioned into not playing around and experimenting with different ways of working, because they're so conditioned to I'm being told from the top that I have to do this and work this way and deliver. Not I'm allowed to play around and within these wider limits of discretion of I can try this. So a lot of the stuff that we try and do is to sort of retrain them into that kind of environment. You create that environment, and then when you're in that environment, this is how you're beginning to have this greater freedom to think and play around. So you get some of the stuff, sort of the design thinking stuff out of Stanford, and those kind of techniques sort of work. We go a little bit wider than that. We try and do even before you get to a design thinking methodology, we try and do, okay, this is how you become more creative. This is how you think critically. This is what cognitive flexibility is. How can we experiment with all of these kind of different cognitive processes before we even give you a process to solve a solution? And so that's really what we try and do is say, right, you guys can solve these problems. You just have to be given the tools to do it. And we'll help you do that.
So what would be a sort of introductory step or sort of bite-size engagement to get something like that happening in an organization?
So we would do, I mean, we like to try and do 1 or 2 day masterclasses where we take them through one of the concepts and then the behaviors. Ideally, then maybe they'll come up with some of the complex problems they've got to they're wrestling with, and we can have a day going through. Okay, well, here, how do we come out of this day with 5 or 6 experiments that you might launch to try and solve these complex problems?
And would that be with the leadership team or a specific business unit or
any
team?
Anyone. Yeah. So the project I'm working on at the moment, we're sort of looking at doing a bit of both. We're doing a more high level one with some of the leaders, but then a process where we're trying to select people that in theory will already have some of these abilities to think differently. So we're trying to, and we haven't sorted out quite how it's going to work yet, but we're trying to use some social network analysis tools to find different thinkers in an organization. So MIT have this idea of have finding wise guys and outliers, and so we're going to try and do that and then bring them into and sort of teach them the skills and then get them back out and give them a bit of power to run experiments in the various different departments they work in.
I'd also like to ask you about something completely different. You've been on LinkedIn a lot, commenting on articles in some cases quite a provocative way and trying to understand the LinkedIn algorithm by trying different posting techniques. What have you tried and what have you learned?
So the initial reason I went onto LinkedIn was to lose my academic voice a bit. So I'm writing all this stuff, which, you know, highly regarded research, but nobody was reading it outside of the researchers. So is it interesting for the wider public and can you make it more interesting by changing your language? So if you look back at the way I used to post, I used to write quite a lot longer articles and threw them up and I was experimenting with what worked and what didn't work and changing writing styles, etc. And there was a period when that was going on and I found LinkedIn absolutely fascinating. It really threw interesting stuff my way and I was reading stuff about organizations and management that I would never have accessed through the standard research stuff that I normally do. And then maybe 8 months, 9 months ago now, something changed. And it all just became self-congratulatory people selling stuff that you look at and you go, that's snake oil. You guys don't know what you're talking about, and you're throwing this onto to LinkedIn, and I know because I've spent 12 years researching this stuff. What you're doing, A, isn't going to work, and B, has a real chance of psychologically harming the people that you're sort of saying you're going to help. So I playing around with the algorithm is really just sort of to see. You know, are people really buying into this nonsense that they're there, or is it the algorithm that's causing it to go viral, or are people really buying into some of this snake oily, low grade discussion around organisations and management? So it's a style and substance thing for me. I'm playing around with my style while still trying to put in genuine substance into a. Yeah, you know, what is supposedly the top professional platform in the world? You know, that everyone on that platform is supposed to be interested about management and leadership and business and organization. So are they?
So does that mean that your hypothesis is that LinkedIn is almost perpetrating organizational misbehavior even more?
I wouldn't say it's a hypothesis. I mean, that. Within the stuff that I find problematic is this idea of sort of over positivity. Just be nice and be positive, and then the organization's going to be a great place. And it would be wonderful if that were the case. You know, if everybody's nice and everyone is positive and happy and et cetera, then organizational life will be incredible. But you can't wish it into being. And that seems so that's one of the elements. There seems to be a wishing of it into being. But at the same time, you've got an element of an identity construction going on. So is all this stuff around work makes you happy, be positive, don't be negative? Is it a way of creating an identity where people are just going to do the work and not complain? Because that part of their identity is, I'm a good, happy worker. And that really goes deeply back into my research, where you can't make somebody a good, happy worker if they're not doing meaningful work. You've got to have the actual good work being done. If you get it, it's not make someone happy despite the work. It's the work actually gives them the purpose. So, and it's not really a hypothesis, but it's a, I see this kind of stuff going on through LinkedIn, and it does worry me quite a bit, because I don't actually think it helps people. I think it probably hurts them.
Yeah, I mean, a crude interpretation of what you've just said is, you can't put lipstick on a pig.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to deal with a pig. Yeah, okay. And have you reached any conclusions yet about the LinkedIn algorithm and how to get it back into a good space again?
So just doing what I'm doing. I mean, I've got a huge number of people following. Loads of people have said to me, I thought you'd stop writing. So going back to sort of some kind of algorithm hacking, I'm at least getting my message out there again. Could it, again, with, I mean, it's not just LinkedIn. I mean, social media potentially can do a huge lot of good, but it potentially can do a huge amount of harm as well. I just want, when I log on to LinkedIn, I want to find stuff that I want to read. You know, at the moment, I'm generally going on searching stuff through the academic journals and through Google to find stuff I want to read. Whereas a year ago, I didn't need to do that. I could just go onto LinkedIn and within, you know, scroll the feed for 30 seconds and I'd find four or five different articles that I found insightful. It's potentially the way I've been hacking the algorithm a bit, I'm beginning to get a little bit more quality stuff back in my feed again. So because people are seeing me and we're talking on my threads, and then their stuff starts popping up in my feed again. So partly it's activity based, and partly it's the content that gets thrown out there. But I'm quite enjoying it. I don't take it hugely seriously. I just enjoy doing it. And I do find it quite often, I do get quite a bit of work through it. So also quite useful.
Very good. Well, we might find out how people can connect with you in a minute. But before we do, are there any trade secrets you can share with people about how they can help themselves not to behave organizationally inappropriately?
Yeah, so I won't mention the company that I'm working with, because if they hear this, they'll know who it is, and they'll probably laugh when they know that I'm talking about them. If we go into the irony stuff, that for me, when everything I'm talking about, you've got unhealthy and healthy reactions to relentless change, uncertainty, ambiguity, all of the kind of things that are part of contemporary organizational life. The unhealthy responses to all of this is quite often zeal. So you have a zealous love of the organization or a zealous hatred of the organization. You have cognitive confusion, emotional exhaustion. All of them can be very, very harmful for you and the organization. You've got some healthy ones, and there's a games playing Machiavellian one. There's a role acting. I just navigate my way through the organization and I display the correct behaviors. But the one I'm most interested in is the ironic response. And the ironic response literally assumes that the gap between the rhetoric and reality is going to be there, assumes that the gap between aspirations and achievements is going to be there, and is acutely attuned to that gap. So they see the difference. And rather than getting angry, that the rhetoric and reality is different. It's a joyous response. It's finding joy in the absurdity that people are thinking one thing and doing something else. And that's the sort of the healthy, the humor, the irony, the joy. That's the healthy response to a gap, to this relentless change. And once you have that, you're then like, how do I start? Even if I can close the gap a little bit, how do I do that? Or how do I solve some of these problems despite this gap going on? What might I do back sort of in a more backstage manner? What might I do behind the scenes a little bit to fix some problems, to have a chat with my colleagues and solve problems? And what you find is, and so one of the pieces I did in India a year or so ago is, what you actually find is when you get people who have this sort of joyous appreciation of the gap and the absurdity, and they don't get angry, and then they go out to have a coffee together or a glass of wine together or somewhere outside the organizational walls. And for me, if everyone has that joyous sort of response, the conversations they have is similar to being at a dinner party after the second glass of wine, where people the conversation starts to flow, and people really begin to start having deep and meaningfuls, and start thinking through potential solutions to problems, and they do it in an enjoyable way. They enjoy the conversation, so. As a self-protection mechanism, irony is brilliant, and also as a way of bonding with like-minded colleagues who are also seeing the gap, and then going out and having interesting conversations with them, and then going back into the organization and activating some of those conversations if it's not too politically dangerous to do so. Really, really useful way, a way to start perceiving the problems and to try and answer them. And the people I've spoken to them, and they actually say, you know, the people I'm working with at the moment, they actually say that quite a lot of their day, and they do have stressful jobs, but quite a lot of the day is bursting out laughing at an absurdity, which is an instant release of stress, and they get some emotional energy from it, and it gives them opportunities to keep on going.
Richard, I find it absolutely fascinating that you've successfully reframed something that's regarded or has been regarded as a negative force in organisations to a positive one to deal with such a massive global problem. So congratulations.
It's only taken me 12 years to get to this point in thinking. It's not been easy.
Well, thank you for sharing so willingly with us today. If people want to reach out to you and connect or follow some of your work, how could they do that?
So we've got a couple of websites, but the best LinkedIn is obviously the best thing. I try and post something most days, and I'm quite happy to have conversations through the messaging system. So I think it's just Dr. Richard Claydon, I think, is my profile. So just search for that. I've got two websites, but neither of them I'm keeping that up to date at the moment because I've got too much other work on. But one of them is theironicmanager.com and the other one is organisationalmisbehaviourist.com. Email, so I also work for a company called The Human Factor in Hong Kong, so you can email me at richard@thehumanfactor.net if you're interested in any talking about anything I've talked through.
Richard, thank you so much for your time today. It's been wonderful speaking, and thank you for sharing.
Well, thank you, Ben. I've enjoyed it.